Hi everyone, welcome to episode 2 of Mazel Tov Cocktail. First of all, thanks for all the great feedback that you've given me on the first episode. Very much appreciated. As always, if you have any ideas or suggestions or feedback, get in touch through our Facebook page or Mazel Tov Cocktail Podcast at gmail.com. We have a great show for you today. I'm talking to my friend Faisal Al-Assad. He's a PhD student in anthropology at Melbourne Uni, currently living in Auckland where he's doing his fieldwork. We're talking to him today about an article he recently published in Overland magazine called The Insecurity Archipelago, Liberal Islam and Its Limits. I'll link to the article in the show notes, but it's not necessary to read it before listening to the interview. So without further ado, let's go. All right, Faisal, thanks so much for joining us on Mazel Tov Cocktail Podcast. We're going to dive in a second and talk about this recent article you've written for Overland called Insecurity Archipelago, Liberal Islam and Its Limits. But first, I was hoping you could just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your current PhD research.
So, as you said, my name's Faisal and I'm from Iraq originally. And I'm doing my research currently on what I'm describing this idea as the contradictory colonial location of Arab migrants. And my research is based at Melbourne Uni, but it's the fieldwork that I'm doing is in Auckland, Aotearoa, New Zealand, where I grew up. And I'm grappling with this idea that migrants in general, but Arabs more specifically as an example, are what you might call colonized colonizers. And I'm dealing with this idea in the field of settler colonial studies. And in this field, you have kind of this schematization of settlers and natives, and then there's migrants. And so I'm just elaborating on this schema, and I'm trying to give flesh to the idea of migrants as sitting in between the settler and the native. And I'm trying to understand it from the perspective of Arab migrants themselves, how this reality appears to them, how they relate to settlers and or natives in different ways. And I'm trying to understand in the context of the wider politics that we are experiencing today in the settler colonial West, the latest and most, I guess, sinister manifestation of which, of course, is Trump and his presidency. And yeah, I guess there are a lot of implications of that that I wanted to explore in this article that I wrote for Overland.
That sounds like totally fascinating and important research. And it's definitely developed since last time we talked about your PhD research. So I definitely want to dig more into some of that as we talk about your article. But to start, you say in your article that while interfascist solidarities are built and consolidated across a global archipelago, we remain confined in both imaginary and practice to islands of hyphenated identities. Let's break this down a little. Firstly, can you tell us what you mean by interfascist solidarities and also about this global insecurity archipelago?
So I've been playing a bit of the magpie with this article that I wrote because I kind of took all these references and concepts from a whole bunch of writers and academics I know. I actually quite a few that, you know, I see on Facebook posting really interesting things. And so I was trying to put this together in the article. So, for example, when I talk about interfascist reciprocity and solidarity, this is something that I took from something that I saw that Ghassan Haj, my supervisor, wrote. And he writes obviously from an anthropology perspective. And so he deals a lot with, obviously, ideas of reciprocity. And he was trying to pin down what we're trying to see, what we're seeing now across the globe, these kind of like correspondences between people like Trump, Marie Le Pen, Geert Wilders. They all seem to be on the same wavelength, and they're all talking to one another, so to speak. And they all kind of exploit the same rhetoric and the same kind of discourses that circulate today, especially amongst white supremacists, and these spaces where xenophobia and anti-immigration sentiment is quite strong. And so there seems to be this very consolidated correspondence between all these different spaces. And I'm essentially just trying to understand how these people are speaking to each other. Whereas on the other hand, we Muslims or Muslim activists or the left or whatever you want to call people who are organized against this bloc, we seem to be, as far as I can see, still talking to ourselves in our own little confined nationally, you know, territorial spaces. And then this insecurity archipelago is something that I take from political scientist Paul Amar, and he's got this interesting concept called the security archipelago. And he was essentially, in his fieldwork and his research, trying to trace how these different forms of power travel across the world and what he calls a metaphorical a chain of islands, where security forces, militarized forces, appropriate spaces of resistance. So, for example, spaces where LGBT movements are quite strong, where indigenous movements tend to be strong. And not only do securitized and militarized forces crack down on these spaces, but they actually tend to appropriate the language that they use. And they translate it into forms of repression and governance. And that essentially travels across parts of the world, like that you might call the global south in a different way of articulating it. So places like Egypt, Brazil, and other places like that. So at the end of the book, Paul Amar says that these forms of power, actually, we can see them kind of being transferred and translated across the global north and in the Western world. They're making their way back in a boomerang effect. And I think we can see that with people like Trump and Wilders and Le Pen and all these people who are kind of appropriating this very militarized, chauvinistic, belligerent kind of discourse. And yeah, they're using it to speak to one another and to speak to the so-called constituents, which you might loosely call the collection of, you know, white supremacists, essentially.
Yeah, so let's delve into the limitations of the responses to these global Islamophobic political forces. In the piece, you talk about these hyphenated Muslim identities. Tell us about what they are and how they come up short against these global transnational political forces.
So I was just trying to think about this basic idea where we might call ourselves kind of Muslim New Zealanders or Muslim Australians or Muslim Americans and Muslim so on and so forth. And when we do that, we're essentially trying to peg our identity onto something tangible. So we've got this idea of the Muslim Ummah, and that's all very well and good. And we can relate to one another through that. But then we also can't seem to talk about ourselves without talking about ourselves within a national kind of space. And this seems to be, at least to me, quite, I don't know how to say it, but in any other way, but it seems kind of outdated and limited in its effects. I don't know what more can offer really in terms of first of all, resistance, but also in terms of forming solidarities with others, other people, other groups who might actually be oppressed by the identity, the national identity, like Australian, New Zealander, American. And I think we do ourselves a disservice by constantly having to reaffirm that identity, not only, you know, a disservice to ourselves and our struggles, but a disservice to our, you know, capacity and effort to form solidarities with others who might see that identity as actually quite oppressive, confining, and limited.
So, yeah, you talk about the discursive construction of nationally bounded Muslim communities as an imagined community within an imagined community. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so imagined community, you know, I obviously take that from the work of Benedict Anderson, and he's talking about the way that nation states and the national imaginary creates this idea of a community of people who you might never meet, but you still feel a relation to. And this is, again, in the context of a national identity, of national politics. But it seems with Muslim communities within the Western world, we create kind of imagined communities within the national imagined community. So an imagined community of Muslims. And again, this will be a group of people you might never actually meet, but you still affect and feel a sense of relationship to them. And increasingly, we see that the imagined part of it is becoming stronger than the community part of it. So spokespersons are happy to keep repeating claims like our community and this community, and our community does this and thinks that. I think recently in Australia, you had a kind of like fake imam or something come out and say that community is trying to build a state within a state. And so all these claims can be made without any kind of material basis. And I'm asking kind of, where does the work that we put into creating community, where's this gone? And a community, more importantly, that is not just imagined, that is not just symbolic, but a community that is politically and socially active and conscious.
So you discuss the internal boundaries drawn by Muslim communities as highlighting dominant and non-threatening aspects of our collective identity. What are these aspects, and why do Muslim communities or people that claim to speak for Muslim communities choose to highlight these?
Look, the thing about that is just as a disclaimer, I fully understand why a lot of Muslim spokespersons end up making claims on behalf of a community, and they are put in that position. And there's obviously an asymmetry of power here. But then again, we have to look at this kind of strategy and really ask whether it's paying off in any way, shape, or form. And just like the imagined communities of nation states, these imagined communities, in constructing this random collection of individuals, they gloss over a lot of asymmetries and inequalities within a nationally, you know, territorial society. Inequalities between working class, middle class, upper middle class, inequalities between dominant European groups and migrant or indigenous minorities. And in the same way, you know, just like all imagined communities, the imagined community of Muslim New Zealanders or Muslim Australians or Muslim Americans glosses over a lot of actually very important and delineating distinctions within this community, distinctions between Arab Muslims, for example, and South Asian Muslims, between the middle class Muslims, middle class socially mobile Muslims, and working class Muslims. And I don't think this is actually very helpful in terms of actually organizing this community in a way that is, in a way that makes us reflexive and makes us conscious of these distinctions. And the more I think that we're conscious of these distinctions, the more that we can create bridges and relationships of, you know, working relationships of solidarity between these different groups in the community and between this community and other communities. Because, of course, for example, you could have an indigenous Muslim who might feel kind of marginalized by this idea of kind of like a homogenized Muslim community. And there's another entirely different part of their life that is not accounted for by this kind of like imagined community.
Yeah, so that's a good starting point to talk a bit more about Muslims and migrants as settlers or within a settler colonial regime and how they relate in particular to Indigenous people. Tell us a bit more about this and also perhaps how this relates to your research. You mentioned in your piece the example of the Australia Day billboard, which was the billboard celebrating Australia Day featuring the two young Muslim girls. It was taken down after Islamophobic complaints, and then there was a liberal campaign to crowdfund to get the billboard back up. Tell us a bit about your analysis of that situation, and also if there are other examples or relationships of solidarity that could happen that are counterexamples to the billboard story.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I just also want to say that this article came out of a much longer running kind of discussion that I've been having with a lot of different a Muslim activists in Australia, New Zealand, and elsewhere. And so already, I mean, there's always different spaces where these conversations are taking place and where solidarities are being created. So I don't want to completely ignore that, but it does seem like the dominant trend is to just kind of prioritize this ethnic Muslim identity at the expense of a political Muslim identity. And we do so by any means necessary sometimes, as we saw with that Invasion Day poster. We kind of just, it seems to me at least, parts of the Muslim community or Muslim activist community really wanted to present themselves as, you know, just another ethnic Australian group. And obviously this was completely politically bankrupted, as other Muslim activists have said and have pointed out. But certainly, I mean, yeah, like you said, there are definitely other ways of doing things. And I think I mentioned it towards the end of the article that, you know, we're starting to see some really promising signs over in the US where groups like Muslims for Ferguson, they've been up and running for a while, and they've made real strides to try and connect with other activist groups within the US, Black Lives Matter, Standing Rock, anti-immigration activists. So I think we can learn quite a lot from those kind of examples. But it does seem that predominantly in the here in Australia and in New Zealand, we're still way behind on that. And we still have some headway to make in terms of creating that real grassroots level engagement.
Yeah, so is that aspect of not wanting to contest a settler identity or not wanting to position yourself as in solidarity with Indigenous people, is that part of what you mean by the drawing of those internal boundaries of Muslim identities and highlighting the dominant non-threatening aspects of those identities? Yeah, I'm interested in your analysis of how this works or how it plays out.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the creation of white settler states, there's it creates the conditions where there's kind of a rat race between different groups, different racialized groups, to race to the top of the racial hierarchy. And certainly Muslim groups, Muslim minorities, especially in this day and age where they are such a hyper-visible minority, for the predominant part, we're kind of trying to make our own space in this white settler formation, and we're not trying actively or deliberately, but it does happen because it is a race after all. We do this at the expense of others. This is inherent in any settler state, because in these settler states, migrants are kind of like the punching bags of the predominant European group. And it's a punching bag that's beaten whenever there's increasing anxieties around the relationship between settlers and natives, particularly, I think. And certainly we see this now in Australia and in the States, particularly because of Standing Rock, which has highlighted that disparity between settlers and natives. And it's a divisive maneuver to try and pit migrants against natives. And in the process, migrants can kind of be interpolated by this idea that they can access whiteness or settler whiteness. Even though, of course, they can't, it's complete fantasy. But there's this idea that they can if they simply play the required role, which is just good old ethnic multiculturalism, stay in your lane, don't rattle any cages, and be the good presentable Muslim, as we saw with that billboard.
You also talk about in your piece about how the politics of respectability and representation in fact alienate young Muslim men and women, and that in turn makes Muslim extremist ideas seem like a more promising alternative. Can you talk a little bit about how that plays out?
Yeah, this was really tied into the whole, I mean, the best example is the billboard. The billboard was essentially an attempt to represent, represent the good Muslim or the unthreatening Muslim. And tied into the idea of respectability. If you represent yourself in a particular way, if you are seen as respectable, I don't know if you watched that interview, but it was just really interesting on the Q&A session where Yasmin Majid is really, I mean, she's really putting in a lot of effort to seem like the nice person, to seem like the kind of approachable, learned Muslim. At some point she goes, you know, I don't want to shout at you. And she's really trying to present her case. But obviously, I mean, I'm wondering who really is convinced by this act. I'm not saying that it's a disingenuous representation, but who are we trying to reach, and are they even listening? And I think for a lot of young Muslim men and women, they're increasingly seeing that this kind of representation is not working. This kind of representation is so far afield from how they feel about the whole issue. And for the most part, they feel anger, they feel alienation, they feel despair at the current state of things. And someone sitting there trying to be all, respectable again, is just not, I don't think it's reaching them. And so they find other groups, groups who can channel that anger, that despair, that alienation a lot better. They find inclusion there instead.
Well, do you have any closing thoughts about how that could be combated, or do you have any thoughts about a language or discourse that could, as you put it, as you put in your piece, shake up the ethno-cultural caging of Muslim identity? Is there a language that's appropriate to that?
I think just having a conversation, because honestly, within these communities that we've created, again, go back to this idea of the imagined community, we've created a space of non-engagement. There's all these different ways of dividing this community, but one of the main ones is the withholding of spaces to speak by, I hate beating this drum, but kind of like the older generation of Muslims who kind of occupy those spaces, and they often actually actively shut down any attempts to introduce a new language, a new way of representing ourselves, and a different way of just affecting our sense of self and our sense of belonging. And I think, yeah, just the first step is just to create that sense of engagement. So it's really, there's nothing profound about this. It's actually quite banal what I'm saying. But yeah, I think that's also, I hope it conveys how kind of basic the solution is, which is just to allow conversation to happen. And as soon as that takes place, I think that can open up so many different avenues for political and social expression within our communities. So yeah, I hope that's a more positive.
Like you said, in the States and in other places, we can see people developing those relationships of solidarity. So yeah, I think it's definitely something that we hope to have you on Mazel Tov Cocktail again to discuss down the track. So I think this has been, yeah, a really interesting conversation. So thanks very much.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great. Thanks.
Cheers, man.
Thanks for listening to Mazel Tov Cocktail Episode 2. It was great to talk to Faisal, and talking to him a bit after the interview, we realized how much our respective PhD projects have similar concerns. My research on transnational Jewish anti-fascism in the middle of the 20th century also looks at the issue of how migrants and marginalized people relate to settler colonial regimes. And the Jewish anti-fascists of this period also were constructing a non-nationally bound political subjectivity aimed at eliminating anti-Semitism through participating in wider struggles. So I think we'll definitely have Faisal on again to continue this discussion in the future. But for now, tell your friends and family about us. Like, share, subscribe. If you can give us a rating and a review on iTunes, that would be awesome. I'll put a link to Faisal's article in the show notes. And our shout out for today goes to our friends at Overland Magazine, who published this piece on their website, but have also for many, many years been publishing fine pieces of analysis, opinion, fiction, and poetry. So if you don't already subscribe to the magazine, check out their website. We highly recommend it. But that's it for today. Thanks. Music in this episode came from the Eastern Watershed Klezmer Quartet.